We study billionaires, and this is episode 44 of The Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is The Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pysh and Stig Broderson.
Hey, how's everybody doing out there? This is Preston Pysh, and I'm your host for The Investors Podcast. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson, out in Denmark. And this is an episode I've been really waiting to do because ever since October, the oil industry has been acting a little funky. And I remember Stig and I distinctly talking about this on one of our earliest podcasts where we were talking about the oil industry and how I had read some article about the supply and demand on oil being all out of whack. And so I got a little scared and a little spooked, and I sold out of most of my oil positions back in October and into November. And it ended up being a very good choice. I'd like to say it was all skill, but it really wasn't. There's obviously a lot of luck that was involved in my decision to move out of a lot of those picks. But ever since that point in time, I've wanted to learn more and more about oil. And Stig and I obviously have a lot of contrasting points of view on oil. And we talk about that on our show from time to time. Last week when we had our mastermind group, we were talking about some of our opposing positions. So what we did is we went out and we found the best author on all of Amazon who wrote a book. And the name of the book is Oil 101. And his name is Morgan Downey. His book, Oil 101, explains the nuts and bolts of the oil business, from its composition on the molecular level to the analysis of the market players, from refining economics to trading. I mean, it just goes on and on. And I mean, this book is so comprehensive. And the thing that I like about it most, Morgan, is the fact that it's written in simple and plain English for anybody to understand, which is a true accomplishment in any type of economics book. So we are so thrilled to have you on the show.
Well, thanks, guys. I'm excited here to be on also. I'm a big fan.
Well, so this is going to be a lot of fun. And before we get into the questions, which Stig and I are obviously going to be probably prepping so that they're in our favor so we can win our argument, our ongoing argument between the two of us. But we want to learn a little bit more about you. I mean, this book is so comprehensive. I know whenever I arrived at my house and I was flipping through it, I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, it took this whole understanding of oil to a whole new level. And I see Stig shaking his head because I know he totally agrees with me. But how did you... what motivated you to write this big comprehensive book on oil?
So it was actually kind of interesting. I wrote the book I wish someone else had written. I was kind of in a similar situation to you guys. I started out as an oil trader many, many years ago, and as a commodity trader, primarily oil. I read everything I could get my hands on in terms of oil markets, the engineering, the whole process of exploration, production, whatnot. And there was very, very little that was well written, first of all. A lot of it was kind of, they were usually highly technical pieces that were written for a pipeline welder in Alaska operating in cold environments. So you had very highly specific technical tests, but you had nothing that explained why the hell do oil prices move from $20 to $150 and then back down to $40. And there was not only was there nothing out there that kind of explained the underlying fundamentals of the oil industry. You had back in 2004, 2005, when I kind of started putting this book together, you had a huge move in oil prices, and the kind of the common media reaction at the time and the kind of man on the street reaction was that it was all speculators, and they were kind of, it was a whole bunch of kind of bogeymen. You know, people were just grasping for straws. And one of the reasons was that there was nothing out there that kind of explained, you know, here's how the price of oil is set at your local gas station or petrol station here outside the US. And it frustrated me when particularly, you know, people would blame speculators or just random events rather than, you know, looking at it from a fundamental basis. We had a supply crisis, and no one was actually talking about the supply crisis that we were in. And there was kind of a movement, there was a whole movement called the peak oil movement that kind of started then. And so there was kind of a demand for information, and information in a simple, straightforward fashion. And I kind of wrote that book I wish someone else had written.
And I can attest to that. And, you know, having seen it, the thing that I really liked is you started really big picture and it's really well organized, where it's not like this scatterbrain of different oil facts and list of assumptions here and there. It is really well organized and thought out the way that you structured the book. And huge kudos to you. I know anybody out there who would read your book, they're going to see that immediately, how well structured it is and how it's a big top level picture, but then yet it digs down into the finer elements. If you really want to go that deep, it's all there. And that's what I really liked, is how it was organized. But we're going to go ahead and Stig's going to go ahead and ask the first question here. And before he asks it, I'm just curious, were you talking about when there was an undersupply? You were talking about like the 2006 to 2007 timeframe?
Yeah. 2005, 2006, when, you know, the prior 25 years, we had $15 oil to $20 oil for such a long period of time. And then within a year, we went from 20 to almost 150.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the impetus, was that defining moment.
Yep. Okay, Stig, go ahead.
Yeah. So, Morgan, there's just this thing that just keeps puzzling me, and that is that you see that the oil consumption has just steadily increased, and you show that in your book. You know, it's just basically increased from the very day that it was invented. And even since, you know, you wrote this book, it also keeps on steady increasing. Now, at the same time, you hear politicians talk about moving away from fossil fuel, and you also see like massive investing in renewable energy. So the logic question for me to ask would be, 50 years from now, do we as a world, like globally, do we consume more oil than today?
I'd be slightly shocked if we will be consuming the similar amount of oil as today, mainly because there's a supply side issue. But it's not going to be because people are demanding less oil. And oil, as you mentioned, the oil industry started in 1859. So it's actually kind of a relatively new industry. You know, your kind of great grandparents were there at the beginning of this industry. And since 1859, oil demand, so consumption of oil, has only fallen three times. And so it's grown every year throughout World War One, World War Two, every year steadily. And the three periods where it fell were 1973, and it only fell for that one year, just that single year of 1973. In other words, there was no growth in consumption. Then the early 1980s, you had 1981, 82, 83, you had a fall off in consumption. And the only ever time oil demand fell was 2009, because you had a spike in prices and you know, the credit crisis and all that kind of stuff. But just that single year, every other year in the 156 years of the oil industry, the consumption has gone up. And you mentioned renewables, and the kind of the underlying thing about oil is that oil is primarily a transportation fuel. And unfortunately for renewables, but fortunately for the oil industry, there's almost no alternative at the moment. I mean, you do have electric cars and electric aircraft. You know, there's that small plane flying around the world, just trying to set a record at the moment, that electric solar-powered plane. So you do have electric cars, but they are a tiny, tiny fraction of the transportation world. So to put the kind of renewables in transportation in perspective, this year there should be roughly 16 million cars sold in the U.S., just the U.S. alone. You know, obviously, but there's huge numbers internationally in China and in Europe and whatnot, but 16 million in the U.S. The number of electric cars to be sold this year in the U.S. is just around 20,000. So, you know, and obviously Tesla and all these guys get a lot of hype and buzz, which they rightly should. You know, it's good to have to have innovation, but the scale of renewables in the transportation field is not on the radar. It's just a fancy rich man's kind of toy right now in terms of renewables.
So what you're saying is that there's a potential for the demand to decrease in a long 50-year period, but you just don't see that happening in the short amount of time.
I don't see it happening. I mean, oil is, as I mentioned in the book, essential to the modern way of life. And, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, modern kids these days are using, you know, Skype more, so you don't have to fly, or using are chatting online, so you don't actually have to physically visit someone, or you're ordering something off Amazon, so you don't actually have to drive to the store. But even with all of that, oil demand is still growing pretty strongly. And so it's one of those things that, you know, people have to get to and from the office, have to get to and from work and school. And, you know, people have said, oh, well, suburbia is ending. Even if suburbia ends, you know, you've got a huge amount of things need to be transported around the world every day. And the only fuel that is used to in transport is pretty much oil. Shipping, airlines, trains, cars, trucks, everything uses oil. There's no real competition for that at the moment. And should there be competition? Yeah, I think it would be a great thing if battery technology evolves and we can kind of ramp up solar and wind, renewable energy. But the big challenge is that the scale of oil consumption is so huge that it's kind of baked into our modern society. And, you know, there's no real kind of alternative out there at the moment.
So, Morgan, I think you have a really good point because, you know, when I'm talking about, like, will the oil demand increase? You know, one thing is to talk about demand of oil. We might also just talk about general energy consumption. And I think that everybody agrees on that the energy consumption will increase in the world. I don't think you can find anyone that will tell you otherwise. But the debate right now is how this demand should be met. Is it with renewables or is it with oil or a third kind of thing? And I think what a lot of people forget is that you can't just replace oil. And I also think that's what you're saying, that oil has some properties. For instance, when it comes to distribution and storage, that you can't do with windmills. You can't do that with solar. It just doesn't work like technologically.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the interesting things that people talk about, renewable energy, oil is just kind of its own bucket. Whereas if you look at electricity, almost zero oil is used to produce electricity just because oil is so expensive and is so energy dense and is so valuable in its use as a transport fuel. You can jam a huge amount of energy into a car tank or an airline's wings or a train. Whereas if you look at electricity production almost all around the world is roughly coal, nat gas, and nuclear, and then a small amount of hydro and wind and other kind of renewables. So there's the world of electricity, which is kind of one part of the energy world, and it's all those kind of, you know, coal, nat gas, and nuclear. And then you've got the world of oil, and the two are not really, they're not fungible. You can't people are trying to solve, the renewable world is trying to solve the electricity issue. But in terms of there being an alternative to oil, there's nothing really out there at any kind of scale at the moment. And even if you do get a ramp up in solar and wind and renewable generation, power generation, that's primarily for use in the electrical grid. If you need power a car, you're going to have battery technology is going to have to improve hugely and dramatically to try and offset oil. And one of the interesting things you mentioned was that 50 years from now, there'll still be a demand for transportation. People still will need to get from A to B and move goods from A to B. But I think that the major challenge is going to be on the supply side. And we've only now started, that big shock in 2005 when oil went from 20 to 150, that was not speculators. That was purely because conventional, easy, onshore oil has begun to decline. And there was this whole movement called the peak oil, movement a few years ago. Everyone was kind of saying, oil production is going to decline forever type thing. And conventional oil production has actually peaked and is declining. That's onshore where you drill straight down and it's cheap oil. It's like $15 to $25 per barrel. And we've shifted up to a newer source because we have run out, are running out of that easy, cheap onshore oil. We've now had to move up the cost curve. And if you're familiar with economics, you move up to more and more expensive cost curves when you burn through your low cost supplies. And so we've moved up to deep offshore, and offshore oil is a $50 per barrel business. That's where it kind of starts. And yet, is there more oil at that price? Yes, but it was much more expensive. If you want to repair an oil rig, you need a wrench 50 miles out into water, you kind of have to, that wrench becomes a $1,000 wrench because you got to helicopter the thing out and back. So offshore oil production is very expensive. And then we've kind of, offshore oil production has not grown to meet the continued growth in demand. And so we've shifted to an even higher cost supply, which is all this fracking. And fracking is actually a natural gas technology. It was primarily way back. It's kind of an old technology. It's, obviously controversial somewhat in the US because people are concerned about what oil leaching into groundwater and the chemicals used in fracking fluids. But it's a very good technology to use for nat gas. And it was developed from the nat gas industry for where you drill down and you turn the drilling pipe sideways, you drill sideways, and then you later on you frack the rock with water. But it only really started to take off in 2009 because oil had reached the price where this new source of supply, it's a very expensive thing to frack for oil. And oil fracking costs $70 to $90, depending on where the fracking is occurring. And so we've moved from conventional onshore, which peaked and began to decline in 2005, and globally, not just in the US and or other countries globally, we moved to deep offshore, which is kind of, you know, US Gulf Coast, obviously the North Sea and all that kind of stuff. It's that's around $50 oil, but that's not enough supply there. So then we were moving higher to fracking supply, and fracking is $70 to $90 per barrel cost in terms of the supply cost. And the problem with fracking is that you look out to 2020, 2021, US fracking oil supply is also going to begin to decline. So all this, because there's only so certain parts of the US that can be fracked for oil. There's North Dakota, West Texas, some parts of Pennsylvania, New York. And so it's great that there's an additional, you know, few million barrels per day produced by the US at the moment. But no, have you noticed that no other country in the world is fracking for oil, or not at the scale as in the US? And so it's kind of, there's a limited, and it's a very high cost new source of supply. And so now we're moving on to what's the next high cost source of oil. And what is next? There's two big areas. One is Arctic oil, which is where you drill way up in the Arctic, in polar regions, where it becomes a much more technically expensive thing because you've got freezing conditions, obviously, and ice flows and all that kind of stuff. But that oil is, anyone's guess, is between $125 and $150 per barrel, but you can produce it. It's there. It's, people can, you can see it, you know, you can do seismic analysis. And then what you've got is, you've got the next highest cost oil is what's called ultra deep offshore oil. And this is in places like Brazil. And, you know, Brazil made a whole bunch of noise, like the Brazilian government, about 5 or 6 years ago, when they said they had discovered this huge oil field, and it was called the Tupi field back then. And it is an enormous oil field. And the challenge with this oil is that it's, and Brazil made, said, we're going to save the world, we're going to produce all this oil. The problem with it is that it cost $200 per barrel to produce that oil. And by the way, the technology to produce it hasn't been created yet because you're drilling off the continental shelf. So you're drilling way down through the water, wow, you know, miles deep. Then you're drilling into the rock. And so it becomes very expensive. And the first barrel of oil that's meant to be produced from this oil, this should be in the early 2020s. And the run, it's roughly around $200+ per barrel. And so we're moving up along through these different supply curves. And so, you know, everyone kind of, you know, knocked all these kind of peak oilers, and there was a certain kind of element of survivalism type thing, and it was, you know, it was almost got wrapped up into this almost evangelical type movement, and so that was kind of what knocked it, I think, sideways. But the big challenge is that we're you know, oil is not a renewable resource. We are burning through our supplies at an obviously an ever rapid rate, and we've burned through all the really cheap stuff. Now we're going to much more higher cost. And you know, if you price oil, it's pure economics. If you price a barrel of oil high enough, you can get oil out of a lot of different things. You can make oil, liquid gasoline, out of coal. You can actually, you know, it's a hydrocarbon. You have to do some, you know, a lot of expensive things to that hydrocarbon to get oil out of coal, or to make or gasoline out of coal. But at $500 per barrel, all other things being equal, you can actually create yeah, gasoline out of any other hydrocarbon. And so you've got a situation where the demand side, demand is going to continue to grow because there's no real alternative at the moment. Electric cars are still a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the world. There's no, the demand will continue to grow. The biggest challenge is on the supply side. And, you know, for all those people that kind of knocked all those peak oilers, they were all kind of right. Conventional oil production has peaked and begun to decline in 2005. That was what caused that big rally in prices. We kind of hit a supply window. And so our supply ceiling, and we had to force the market up to the, to pay for the newer higher price oil, which was, you know, off deep, offshore, and then fracking oil. So
right now, so it's really interesting that you say those things, because you're talking about how expensive the oil could get here in the future. And the question that I've got, so in January of 2015, and our show obviously likes to study these different billionaires. So that's where this question's going. So we had this billionaire over in Saudi Arabia. His name is Prince Bin Talal.
Bin Talal al-Waleed. Prince al-Waleed Bin Talal. He's a famous guy in the finance world.
I'm going to go with your pronunciation of that. he said that he will not see, or that the world will never see another $100 barrel of oil again. And I found this article. This was in the USA Today that they wrote this. In fact, we'll put the link to the article on the show notes so people can see this. But it was in the USA Today. And I found this to be totally mind blowing that somebody could come out with his credentials and his background and being so intimately familiar with oil over in Saudi Arabia that he would say something like this. So I'm really curious to hear your opinions on why do you think he has this long-term opinion of oil remaining below $100?
It's kind of interesting. You know, it's kind of like if you're a kid of a rich family, everyone thinks that your opinions are much more weightier and deserve a credibility, whereas that may not be the case. And so everyone thinks that everyone in Saudi Arabia knows everything about oil. It's kind of like saying everyone in Idaho knows everything about potatoes or things like that. Obviously he's a billionaire and he made a lot of his money, not in oil. He made it in other areas, in finance and a whole bunch of other things. But obviously Saudi Arabia is a very unusual country. It's entirely dependent on oil. There's no other industry there. There's no tourism there's a tiny amount of tourism, but there's no kind of at scale type industry. And Saudi Arabia is obviously the leader of OPEC. They're kind of the de facto leader of OPEC. And OPEC's, their only ambition in the world is to have higher oil prices. And so they try and, reduce supply occasionally to try and prop up prices. So the challenge I have with a statement that we'll never see $100 oil again is that, okay, so where is this additional, I'm a guy that looks at numbers and sort of physical supply and demand. So you're going to have demand is continuing to increase. Every year it grows by 1 to 1.5 million barrels per day. We're up to the mid 90 million barrels per day of consumption right now. Where's all this additional supply going to come from? And, to say that we'll never see $100 oil, that means you're basically by default saying we're going to find cheap onshore oil. But where is that cheap onshore oil? I don't know where that is. There's some cheap onshore oil, but not enough to meet demand growing at 1.5 million barrels per day. You're saying that also that fracking is going to go international, that you'll have fracking in Saudi Arabia, in Europe, in Russia. That hasn't happened yet. And there's a whole variety of reasons why fracking is kind of uniquely a US thing at the moment. But basically, you're making an assumption that you're going to see all these sources of supply that are going to come out over the next 5 to 10 years that are going to be under $100 per barrel. Though I don't know where those sources exist. So on the supply side, he's definitely wrong. There are no huge sources of oil that are coming in online under $50, $75 a barrel. There's just not that. Wow. So then maybe he's saying that demand is going to collapse, that oil, people are going to become much more efficient. And there's a famous thing in, obviously oil grows pretty much with population. So it kind of relatively steadily has grown over the last 155 years. And so, maybe people are saying, I'm trying to reverse his logic here or try to go through his logic, maybe saying, okay, people are just going to become much more efficient with their use of oil. And so there's an interesting thing in oil markets where it's kind of it's something that also occurs in other markets where every time efficiency increases, you burn more of that underlying commodity. So if you look at cars in the US, it used to be 15 years ago, cars would get 15 miles per gallon or 10 miles per gallon. We're now up to, you can get a car today, just a regular Ford or whatever, that can get 40 miles per gallon. It drives and looks like a regular car. It's using some hybrid technology, some regenerative braking. The engines are much more efficient. They're smaller engines, but they're turbocharged, so you can actually get more efficiency out that way. So you've got a trend where miles per gallon of the average cars on this road in the US and globally is increasing pretty at a decent rapid rate. But the interesting thing is that what do people do when they get a more efficient car? They buy a larger car. And so if you look at SUVs around the world, SUV sales are actually quite healthy. And so people, even though the underlying consumption device, airlines, use more efficient jet engines, ships use more efficient marine engines, cars get more miles per gallon. And all that the average consumer does is they fly more because airline tickets become cheaper. They ship more stuff, buy stuff because Amazon can ship it cheaper. All those things. Everyone thinks that Amazon, the world of the future, and Google buying stuff off the internet involves no oil consumption. It involves almost the exact same oil consumption as if you drove to the store, because Amazon now have to ship this single box to you. It has to go through a whole network of planes, boats, and and trucks to get to you, all that requires diesel, usually for commercial transportation. And so there's no efficiency out there that's not being offset by higher consumption at the moment. So I don't think that he can. What are the underlying facts that he would say that oil can never go above 100? There's no supplies, huge sources of supply coming out under $100 per barrel. And are people going to become more efficient? Engines are becoming more efficient, but people are then using that efficiency to consume more oil. So, you know, by shipping more products, by flying more on airlines, by buying larger cars, or just turning on the air conditioning in a car, you know, or adding additional devices.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
In a world where convenience often compromises security, many investors settle for solutions that do not fully meet the demands of Bitcoin security. That's where the Bitcoin Way comes in. Offering a personalized white glove service, they will guide you through every step of the way to achieve full self-custody, ensuring you adhere to the strictest self-custody standards. Their experienced team helps establish robust security practices that cover all aspects of self-custody, cybersecurity, and privacy. Their ultimate goal? To empower you to become fully sovereign. Beyond securing your Bitcoin, they also offer services such as inheritance planning, Plan B strategies, assisting in relocating to Bitcoin-friendly locations to further enhance your sovereignty, and much, much more. Take the first step to true financial independence. Visit thebitcoinway.com/TIP to schedule your free consultation call. Don't delay in securing your generational wealth the right way. Opt in for security over convenience and protect your future. Your family line will thank you.
If you're a solopreneur, small business owner, or remote worker, then listen up because you've got to hear about Industrious. As a remote worker myself, I'm telling you that Industrious delivers the best co-working space I have ever been to. Industrious has co-working locations in major cities across the US, UK, Europe, Asia, and Australia, and they provide a ton of benefits to their members. They have secure high-speed internet, daily breakfasts and snacks, courteous on-site staff support, and my favorite part is the social events they host, which make it easy for me to connect with others who want to unplug from their work for a bit. I just recently visited their Kansas City office, and the people there were absolutely amazing, and the staff was incredibly helpful to help me get settled in and perform at my best. We Study Billionaires loves Industrious, and they were able to hook our listeners up with a free week of co-working to check it out, take a tour, and experience all of the amazing perks they have to offer. Visit industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to redeem a free week of co-working when you take a tour. That's industriousoffice.com, click join now, and use code WSB to get your first week entirely for free. Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com.
All right, back to the show.
And I will say this, in the article, it did not list anything that he said quantifiably why he felt that way. It was just like, hey, I feel it's never going to be higher than $100. And that was pretty much like the essence of the article.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that because I'm come from the trading world, I'm a very much of look at supply, look at demand. And it's an adding the numbers up type game. And that you can actually, oil demand is actually relatively easy to model mathematically because it's the law of huge numbers. You've got 6 billion people. And people, when you get up to those scale of numbers, people behave very predictably.
Yeah.
And so you've got When you boil it down to, people drive to and from work every day, to and from school, and at scale, it's very easy to model consumption. And the supply side is kind of the more difficult thing to model for oil markets, because you do get these lumpy and also technological shifts. You do, like, fracking only really took off in the US in 2009, but because it required oil to be at $100 to kick off that industry. And so the supply side, you've got a lot more dynamic things going on. And there is a definite progression of technology on the supply side. But it's much more difficult to predict the supply side than it is the consumption side. And so I think he's probably saying it obviously maybe he thinks that the world's going to become more efficient, but history has shown that has not ever been the case with oil.
And you don't know whatever his political intentions might have been for saying that over in Saudi Arabia. Maybe he's got some other intention tied to that comment or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, and the thing about the Saudis, that I don't want to kind of necessarily pick on the Saudis, but, their entire economy is 100% dependent on oil. Of the 94, 95 million barrels per day of supply in the world, just over 10 million of that, it comes from Saudi Arabia. And so it's something where politically, obviously oil is a very strategic commodity, just because everything, jets, the military machinery, all operate in oil. I would almost argue that every war since 1900 has been won and lost, and a lot of the strategic decisions were based on oil. Japan going down to try and get to Indonesian oil, that was their reason to push down and try and knock the US out of the Germans going into Eastern Europe, to get to the oil fields in Russia. That was to their detriment. They wasted a lot of energy and obviously people going east during that thing to get to oil. So oil is a very strategic thing. And so people are cautious about what they say. And some, obviously, when your only business is oil, then you're even more kind of cautious and kind of an interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, so Morgan, I can't help to think about this from the perspective of the stock investor. Because it seems to me, and the reason why Preston's laughing is that I always, when I have a guest, I always say, well, so if I'm a stock investor, .. So that's why he's laughing. So Morgan, looking from the perspective of the stock investor, when we think about the oil industry, we typically think about companies like Chevron, Exxon, Shell, and so on. Like these big vertical integrated companies that might be quite vulnerable to the oil price because they have a given cost structure, as you said, depending on how they export that oil. And then the revenue is basically the oil price. Now, I'm kind of thinking, I'm not sure I want to be in that industry, but I might want to be in the oil service industry because that is supplying equipment to that industry. Would you agree that that industry is less vulnerable to the fluctuating oil price?
Unfortunately, I think it's even more vulnerable. And one of the reasons for that is that if you look at obviously fracking over the past few years, Schlumberger, Halliburton, if you're doing a frack job, as in Exxon don't do the fracking of the well themselves, they hire Baker Hughes, Schlumberger, or Halliburton to do that fracking for them. And a lot of those companies have gotten hit hurt their stock price, those oil services companies. Have got hurt because they've lost a lot of that fracking business when oil moved down to the 40s and 50s over the past few months at the end of last year. And so I would almost argue that oil service firms like those Halliburton, Schlumberger, Baker Hughes, they're almost more levered version of exposure to oil prices. And companies like BP and Shell and Exxon, they're much more closely tied to the price of oil, to flat price oil movements. And so I would almost argue the opposite, that it's the oil majors are much more closely correlated to the price of oil. And it's not, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing that they're correlated to the price of oil. One of the biggest things in the oil market in the past few years has been all these ETFs for oil services funds and ETFs for trying to track the underlying price of oil. And there's a big famous one called USO. And the problem with some of these ETFs is that they use futures contracts, oil futures contracts, and it doesn't really work that well, at least in my opinion. And if you look at the performance of those ETFs, it doesn't really work that well when you have an ETF based on oil futures, because oil futures themselves are kind of, there's a whole bunch of transaction costs involved with them and whatnot. But if you want to most, the most pure play for, you know, on the oil industry is obviously just one of those majors, the Exxons, and they're still very well run companies, and they are correlated with the price of oil. So you have to be willing to roll with some fluctuations and oil price correlations. But I would say that they're almost a less leveraged version play on oil than the oil services companies. The oil services companies, they get hit when oil prices fall. Everyone starts cutting oil services, almost, you know, it's a more exaggerated or more levered version of the oil majors.
So I got a question for you, Morgan. I think a lot of people listening to this podcast are very curious to get the inside scoop of what you think has really happened over the last 6 months. And yeah, I'm just, we had a guest on the show and he made the comment that the U.S. it was payback to Russia. And I think you talk to anybody in the industry, they're all saying that it has to, and I see you smirking. So you've heard, you've heard this story too. So I really want to hear your opinion and whether that story holds any truth and just kind of your whole take on it.
Okay. So the oil industry has always got all these conspiracies surrounding it. There's, you know, there was that whole thing in the 1980s where people think that the Soviet Union was ultimately collapsed by the US, Ronald Reagan telling, you know, the Saudis to pump as much oil as possible and let's get these, let's crush the Soviet Union. So there's always kind of these kind of underlying conspiracy theories. But at the end of the day, it actually is pure, there's just pure economics. There's nothing really, you know, politics does play a certain, is a certain part of the story, but it's purely economics. And so what happened was, up until August of 2014, up until August of last year, for the prior 5 years, since 2009, oil had been at, and I'm talking about oil as WTI crude oil, which is the US kind of benchmark. The WTI crude oil had been around $100 a barrel, give or take $10. So, and for 5 years, that is an incredibly stable oil market for 5 years. And it, and there was a whole bunch of dynamics underneath that, behind the scenes kind of in the oil market, the stability of oil at $100 enabled the fracking industry to flourish. It basically said, you know, you can get your oil, it costs $80 per barrel or $70 per barrel, but look, oil is $100 and it's been stable there at $100 for, so it encouraged all this new supply, which the oil, it's just pure economics. The oil market needed to encourage that high cost oil to come out of the ground. And so you had that kind of creation of that whole new industry, the fracking industry. And so up until August 2009, and then what happened in August 2009? You had a few major things happened. One is, you had there was Libya, a decent sized oil producer. Those guys had gone through a whole bunch of turmoil with their oil industry. But during the months of August, September, October of last year, their oil production doubled within a few weeks or a few months. And so, and they're not a huge producer, but everything in the oil market kind of moves at the margin. They went from just over 1 million barrels per day to over 2 million barrels per day. So that was that. That was kind of a first thing that kicked off everything. Then you had,
because they're all trying to keep market
kind of oil to fall a little bit.
Morgan, so what you're describing here is that basically one person starts producing more. Everyone wants to basically keep their market share. So then they start producing more, and it gets competitive. Is that what you're saying?
No. Actually, that used to be the case many, many years ago. And if you read of oil, it's in that first chapter of Oil 101. But these days, everyone produces flat out, including Libya. And usually, it's the reason they wouldn't produce flat out is because of a war, and that was a good situation in Libya. And there are a whole bunch of other countries where, just because of Iran, is because of sanctions, they're producing about a million and a half barrels per day less than they would like to. They would actually like to, but they don't. They can't buy the proper pipes, the pumps, the do the seismic tests that they need to do because they're operating under sanctions. The only country out there that actually deliberately withholds oil from the market is Saudi Arabia. And so they do it under the auspices of OPEC, so they can point a finger at someone else. But it's pretty much Saudi Arabia is the only country. Every other country and every other company in the world produces as much as they can if they can make a dollar out of it. So if they can make it, get out of the ground at 80, sell it for 81 at market, then they'll do that. There's just simple economics. So in Libya, oil production went up by over 1 million barrels per day back in August of last year. And it kind of came out of nowhere. I was surprised, you know, there was a lull in the fighting and some stability there. And so oil production kind of recovered. That hadn't been expected. The second thing was that you had dollar started to rally, and oil is kind of a currency. So it's kind of a, when I talk to, fellow oil traders and whatnot, we don't talk about kind of the top line stuff in the oil market. We always look under the hood. And so oil is a currency. And so the dollar started to strengthen. All these, everything against the dollar, including like the euro, the, all the other currencies, including commodities, started to sell off. So you had a sell-off in the dollar, stronger dollar, weaker oil prices. So you had Libya recovering kind of unexpectedly out of nowhere. You had the dollar starting to strengthen. If you look at a chart of the dollar index, the ticker is DXY, you can kind of see that. It started off in August. And then the third thing, which was kind of one of the more critical things, was that there's two big organizations that do oil demand forecasts. One is the EIA, and the other one is the IEA. And when they do their big demand forecast, they use IMF and World Bank economic growth forecasts. And so if you look at starting in August of last year, people started to ratchet down global demand economic growth for 2016. And so that whole kind of, because of mainly a lot of it was due to China, but then it was kind of the class that all the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, people had expected them to grow at 8%. Now they're only going to grow at 6% per year. So they're still growing, but just not as rapidly. And all of those, that confluence of Libya, the dollar starting to tick higher, and global economic growth forecasts being reduced, and being reduced by decent big amounts, that kind of pushed oil down to, say, $75 from $100. So it'd been 5 years stuck at 100. Now we're down to 75. And so then OPEC met it was in November of last year. And one of the most unusual OPEC meetings ever, in that they all met, and everyone else always listens to what the Saudis say. And there's a Saudi oil minister, his name is Al Naimi, he's famous in the oil world. And he usually, everyone hangs on, he's like the Janet Yellen, everyone hangs on every single word. And his facial expression and all that kind of stuff, because Saudi Arabia is the only country that deliberately tries to manipulate prices. They withhold oil that they could otherwise produce. And so usually oil drops $25 a barrel. You expect OPEC and the Saudis to say, we are going to support, we're going to cut our production by, because Libya has increased by 1 million and demand was expected to grow next year by 2 million barrels per day. Now it's only going to grow by 1.5 million. So someone has to take 1.5 million barrels per day of supply out of the market to balance it and stop prices falling. So that's kind of the underlying kind of logic of going into that OPEC meeting in November. And Al Naimi said nothing.
Yeah.
And OPEC said nothing. And it was kind of crickets. You could hear the chirping of the crickets in Vienna, where OPEC is based. And one of the most interesting things is that the Russian oil minister, the CEO of one of the Russian oil companies went to this meeting as well. And Russia's not part of OPEC. They're a similar size oil producer as Saudi Arabia and the US, but they're not part of OPEC. And so, but one of the heads, and supposedly he's Putin's number two guy, the OPEC meeting, as just to kind of to listen in and participate. And he came out of one of these meetings and he said, you would expect them to say something supportive of oil prices, as in we're looking to help OPEC cut supply. Instead, what he said was, we, Russia, we're not going to cut supply. In fact, we can't, because we kind of need the money, and technically it's difficult during the winter. It was a nonsense type statement, but if you're in that position, you should never say that publicly. Say, we're going to continue to produce and we're not going to support OPEC. So basically you had a confluence of Libya, the dollar stronger, the slowdown in economic growth, so still growth, but a slowdown in economic growth all in August. Then in November you had an OPEC meeting that where OPEC itself and none of the ministers, particularly Saudi oil minister, said nothing. Russia said negative things, to try and almost force the oil market to fall even further. And so we drifted down to the low 40s. And then you started to hear all these kind of things about Saudis were saying, well, why aren't you cutting? What's the logic here? And basically kind of came out in a whole series of articles and whatnot over, it's kind of almost like Kremlinology back in the Soviet Union days. People look at OPECology, and so you kind of read these articles, you look for certain kind of phrases or keywords. And it basically came out that the Saudis in particular, they were looking at the growth of US and Canadian oil production over the past few years. And Since 1973, the Saudis have controlled the price of oil, or at least have tried to. They've sometimes lost control of it, but and they do that by withholding production. And the only way you can do that is that you've actually got to be the marginal. You've got to be the only guy out there with that excess supply. And so what they've tried to do is they basically are trying to wipe out the U.S. fracking industry. All these guys that are $75 per barrel, $80 per barrel, they're trying to wipe them out and remove them as a source of supply, such that Saudi Arabia is the marginal oil producer. And so they, you know, for does that make sense for them to do that, or economically or whatnot? There's a whole debate around that. But basically, they've said, and they've said it much more clearly since November of last year, they basically have said we're not going to cut oil production in order to support prices. So it was that whole confluence of things was very unusual. You know, what happened since then is that demand growth wasn't as bad as people had expected it to be. So oil prices kind of hit the 40s. You had a collapse in U.S. fracking. So, you know, all that new source of supply, U.S. oil supply had been growing at almost 2 million barrels, an additional 2 million barrels per day. And to put it in perspective, you know, the world consumption grows around 1.5 to 2 million barrels per day. But the growth in U.S. supply stalled completely. It stopped. If you look at the numbers come out every Friday called the Baker Hughes drilling rig numbers, rig utilization has been collapsing. So the growth in U.S. supplies stalled. You had demand was not as bad as it had been expected to be. So this is the demand from last August. People were expecting a huge drop off in oil demand. It hasn't been as bad as expected. And then Libya, after a little lull where there was a stable situation, they actually have gotten even worse again. So now all that Libyan oil that was hitting the market is no longer hitting the market. And so we recovered back up to $60 or $55.
So I love your comment about oil being like a currency. And when you say that and we look at the current condition in the world right now with China, really their market, their equity market has fallen apart. I think you have a lot of people really running to the U.S. with looking at the dollar as being one of the strongest currencies of all these fiat currencies, which are all just miserably terrible. But you see a lot of people running the U.S. You have the Fed talking seriously about potentially raising rates before the start of 2016. And you made the comment that oil typically moves in the opposite direction of the strength of the dollar. So I'm real curious. Do you see oil prices kind of staying where they're at based on those circumstances and treating it as if it's a currency?
So you've got... So just looking at, and you know, it kind of is a currency in that in some parts of the world, oil is used as a barter. People sell, you know, give oil to get goods. And so it actually is kind of a currency in itself. But the one thing, unlike like you mentioned, a fiat currency where you can just print, double the currency in circulation, you cannot do that with oil. It's a limited supply. And also there's not that much in storage, you know, say the world consumes 95 million barrels of oil per day, and it's a just-in-time, real-time operation because oil companies, Exxon and BP and Shell, they don't like to sit there with tanks, huge, huge tanks full of oil because that costs money to buy that oil and store it and it doesn't sit well for too long in tanks. It degrades relatively quickly. And so it is a currency and if the dollar has been strengthening a lot over the past 6 months, a year, and if the dollar does continue to strengthen, then oil will likely sell off in dollar terms. So it does definitely trade as a currency. I remember back a few years ago, there was this big push to trade oil in euros and trade oil in yen and all this kind of stuff, or trade oil in rubles or Chinese yuan. And the problem with that is that no one tells the oil market trade oil in dollars. Like the U.S. government doesn't say, hey, you must trade oil in dollars. There's no edict from anyone. The reason oil is traded in dollars is that it's the most liquid currency. And in markets try and...
Literally.
Yes. And people try and find, you know, efficiency in if it were cheaper trade oil in euros in terms of the bid-ask spread, every time you have to buy and sell euros, it's a tiny fraction at scale more expensive to do that than it is to buy and sell in dollars. And so the reason the oil market trades in dollars is because it is the most liquid, actively traded currency. It's not because anyone tells anyone. And if, you know, it does trade as If all things being equal, it's just classic economics. If the dollar is stronger against the euro and all other currencies, then the oil should sell off also in dollar terms.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. As someone who's constantly on the road and traveling, Briggs & Riley has been a game changer that ensures my travel experience is phenomenal. I'm a satisfied customer of Briggs & Riley myself, and I can certainly tell you that their luggage performs. It's extremely durable, it has amazing features that make packing and getting around easier, and they have the best lifetime guarantee in the industry. If your bag is ever broken or damaged, they'll repair it free of charge, no questions asked, even if your airline damages the bag. They also just released their Simpatico collection of hard-sided luggage. It has this new one-touch feature which allows you to expand your luggage, pack it, then compress it to its original size so a carry-on can still fit in the overhead compartment, plus many other cool features. If you want luggage that was awarded the best carry-on by Forbes, then now's the time to get it. Get your new and improved luggage at Briggs-Riley.com. That's Briggs-Riley.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
So I have this question, because you said before that the world consumption right now was approximately 95.
Just under, 95 million barrels per day.
Yes, 95
million barrels per day.
Million barrels per day, yeah. And I just read in a blog post here the other day that I think since 2009, where your book was from, the U.S. Production has increased by 3.2. And from that 3.2, 2 million of that barrels per day, that was from shale oil.
Yeah.
Now, so that was actually something that was real interesting for me, especially when I read your book, because in your book you present shale oil and you also introduce the concept energy return of investment.
Perhaps
you can first explain the concept energy return on investment, and then your opinion on shale oil.
Yeah, sure. The energy return on investment is that to get a unit of energy out of a usable unit of energy out of the ground, you have to spend energy to get that. So the easiest way to think about it is that if you're to drill a well, you've got to power that diesel generator to drill that well. And so you've got to burn energy to get to the energy to get. And so over time, drilling on dry land has got a high return, energy return on investment, because you don't have to helicopter things out. You don't have to build an offshore oil rig. You don't have to build any of these kind of deep underwater pipes. You just can build a simple rig on dry land using very little energy, and yet the return is huge. You get a lot of energy out of the ground from oil. So basically, over time, going deep offshore, and then with fracking, the amount of energy required to be spent to get energy out of the ground has been increasing. So the energy return on investment has been decreasing. So in other words, it's becoming much more energy intensive to produce, to get usable energy out of the ground. So it kind of sounds like a strange thing, but it's basically at its core, the cost of supply on energy has been increasing over time and will continue to increase. So that's kind of one concept. It's called energy return investment. But the other thing is that on shale oil, and so I in writing that the book, I kind of slightly regret using the phrase shale, because there's what I should have actually referred to, the fracking is actually what's called tight oil, tight oil industry, because basically the oil is locked in very tight little pores, and you've got to blast through those pores to link them all using water pressure. And so it's all this fracking oil is coming from what's called tight oil reserves. A lot of that tight oil is in a type of rock called shale. And so that's kind of fracking, the fracking industry. Separately, there's a type of rock called shale, which is immature oil. And it's basically oil that if you leave it cook for another several million years, it will eventually turn into liquid oil. But it's basically called shale. And so that technology is very expensive. That, to actually make oil out of that immature rock, you have to, just like you can make oil out of any hydrocarbon, it takes a huge amount of energy to make oil from shale. But to do tight oil fracking, which sometimes involves fracking shale rock, as in you blast through the shale rock. And so that's what's the confusing part of, which I probably will have to clarify in the next edition, of fracking tight oil, which can be oil locked in shale rock. And then there's another process of making oil, actually cooking oil out of shale rock, physically transforming a rock called shale into oil. And so there's a kind of it's one of the things, actually, the challenges with writing Oil 101 was that kind of nailing down common terminologies, because, you know, my pet peeves is when people say gas, and I hate that phrase, just gas, because in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, you mean natural gas? Or, oh no, if you mean gasoline, or do you mean aviation gasoline or motor gasoline? And so I usually like to pick one phrase and use it very precisely. So there's motor gasoline, there's petrol is kind of a slang for motor gasoline, or gas in the US is slang for motor gasoline. But it's one of the challenges with writing Oil 101 was finding that kind of common terminology, of which I probably didn't explain as well as I should have, was that fracking and tight oil, as a distinct process from making oil out of shale, which is where you take a rock and kind of cook that rock into, by adding hydrogen and whatnot, also make it, turn it into a usable product like gasoline or jet fuel.
Absolutely. Wow. Fascinating. Wow. I'm so impressed. I'm serious. I know whenever I saw your book, I was like, this guy knows what he's talking about. And as everyone in our audience can tell, this is incredible.
Yeah, and I almost think that I'm unfair to you, Morgan, because, you know, I picked, and it got to be, you know, completely on three lines from page 27 in your book, and then you can just, you know, keep on talking about how you can refine it. I'm just completely floored about the knowledge you have about your own material.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was kind of an interesting thing in that the researching, because I knew a lot about the oil industry originally. I had done a lot of background reading, and I had exposure. I know a lot of people, and I actually worked in the oil industry, so there was that. But the actual writing of Oil 101, I think the end book was something like 380 pages, and I don't consider myself to be a natural writer. And so I had a whole bunch of people help me with editing and all this kind of stuff. But the original version, I remember I printed it out one day, and it was something like 1,800 pages. And I kind of looked at it on my desk, went, And it took me about 3 years to edit it down. And a lot of that was due for readability. And so I would hand it to someone who had no idea about anything about the oil industry. So I would hand it to my mother and say, here, read this and tell me, is it entertaining first? And so I tried to put in, what do I call them? Like knowledge bombs, like put in little things in every page that people would go, ah, I didn't realize that, and make them kind of like interesting, such that, because there's nothing worse than reading kind of an engineering text of, okay, here's a chemical process. You got to say something interesting about, you know, one of the kind of little things like, you know, why is the acronym for oil in the oil market is BBL, but there's only one B in barrel. Where does the other B come from? And so it goes back to the Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller's blue barrel. The original barrels that were standardized in the oil industry of 42 gallons per barrel were blue barrels. And that's why everyone in the oil market today calls a barrel by acronym BBL. And it comes from that little thing.
So I've got a question for you. And I was watching Stig. He was placing a trade while we were talking there. I can see he's buying more oil companies right now. The question I got goes to, there's a lot of these TV commentators on TV talking about the price of oil. And I think the most prominent one that everyone knows is Boone Pickens, billionaire Boone Pickens. He's from Texas. He's on TV all the time. And I'm real curious because I know recently he's been saying that oil is going to be within a year, oil will be like $80. He's making these predictions and stuff, which Stig and I usually shy away from any kind of predictions. But I'm real curious for you, Morgan. I mean, you're so intimately familiar with this stuff. Who's the person that you really pay attention to? I know for like investing, we watch the Fed like a hawk. They have a huge influence on the impact of where the market's moving, things like that. But who's one of those key people that you follow for the oil industry that people could maybe latch on to? If this person says something, it's usually a pretty valuable piece of information.
Well, there's obviously, I listen to myself first.
I would imagine so.
But I do that. But gosh, it's one of those interesting, and I know T. Boone Pickens, he's a obviously famous guy. I always, when I hear of T. Boone, I always remember that guy in The Simpsons, you know, the cowboy in The Simpsons. and I actually think that it's based on him because T. Boone Pickens was a big buyout guy before he was famous as he is right now for a hedge fund. He was famous in the 1980s.
I think it is.
He it's interesting. I could have actually written it into Oil 101, but one of the Seven Sisters, they were called. They were this big bunch of companies that controlled oil from the 1930s to up until OPEC in 1970. And one of those big companies was called Gulf Petroleum. And if you look at it, if you look right now, there's a few in the northeast of the U.S. gas stations or gasoline stations that sell Gulf Petroleum. But T. Boone Pickens was the guy that actually did a buyout of Gulf Petroleum. So he's actually a famous guy. He, you know, in the oil industry for not just his statements, but for just the history of the industry. Do I listen to him in terms of oil price predictions? I think he's a very colorful character. A lot of what people say on TV and whatnot is usually a very extreme thing to try and get a reaction or get a buzz. It's kind of almost like writing a headline. You need to say something sensational. So who do I listen to? Obviously, anything that comes out of Al Naimi, who's a Saudi oil minister, that is like you have to listen to where is he going? So is he in China? Is he in Russia? Who's he meeting in China? What has he said in China? So Saudi oil minister Al Naimi is one of the critical people that anytime he says anything or just where he is.
Is he on Twitter? I say that jokingly, but somewhat serious.
No, actually, I don't think so. Maybe someone should create a Twitter account for him, the fake Al Naimi.
Yeah.
So let's get on it right now.
That's not a bad idea. I know I'd follow it.
Oh, yeah.
He's obviously a critical guy. In terms of kind of analysts and people kind of in the published research and whatnot, there's a whole ecosystem of these individuals. The interesting thing is that a lot of these people kind of have a bias. So Al Naimi is obviously a Saudi oil minister. He has got a bias toward higher prices all the time. So you have to look with that lens, look at what he says with that lens of course, this guy wants higher prices. So, you know, bear that in mind when he says anything. So a lot of, if you look at, some people that work at that do research at banks. There's good research produced by Citibank. I mean, it's kind of a lame thing to say in a kind of banks kind of a, but it's they produce some really good research. They've got a really good research team there.
Do you have any like online resources that we could put into our show notes or like a link that you could provide to us for that?
I can indeed. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that'll be great. So if you're listening to this and you want to see what Morgan provides, Stig and I, we'll have that in the show notes and you can go to that and click on those links and then you can use those from now into perpetuity as you continue to research your oil.
And number one will be the fake Al Naimi.
exactly.
Okay, so Morgan, the final question that we have, that's about books. So do you have any books that have dramatically shaped your life? A book that has really had an impact on you and why? Has the book had an impact on you?
Hey, interesting. one of the books that kind of got me interested in financial markets was Liar's Poker, Michael Lewis.
Yeah.
Great book. Well written, very entertaining. He's a great writer. I love everything he writes. But
we're big fans of Michael Lewis.
Yeah. And I like the way he makes everything very accessible, like things like Moneyball and those other books are also, I like his kind of approach to looking at an issue or a story, but looking at it from a different angle. But that was his first book, I believe it was his first book, called Liar's Poker, written about the trading floor at Salomon Brothers back in the day. And that kind of got me, that was the book that inspired me to get, or one of the books that inspired me to get into financial markets. It turned that whole kind of space into, made it very interesting and compelling. And obviously, parts of what I'm sure were exaggerated and whatnot, but that book was one of the formative things that made me kind of want to get into the world of finance.
Yeah, we're huge fans of his. And you're right, that was his first book. That's what gave him his big name. And Stig and I did an episode where we talked about his most recent book, the high frequency trading book that he recently did. So.
Oh, yeah, Flash Boys.
Yeah,
Flash. That's great. That's a great book also. Yeah, I mean, he writes well. He writes very entertainingly. He's kind of an interesting author in that I also think he's kind of got a bit of a bias.
He
kind of has this love-hate relationship with Wall Street.
Yeah.
That he kind of hates Wall Street, but he loves to write about Wall Street. So, he writes really well. That Flash Boys is also a great book.
Well, fantastic. So for our audience, so Morgan Downey is his name. He wrote the book Oil 101. You should have no problems finding it on Amazon. If you go on the Amazon, just type in Oil 101. It'll be the first thing that pops up. We highly recommend that if you're interested in the oil industry, this is the go-to book. This is better than any book out there that I've ever seen on oil. So, and it's by a landslide. It's not even a comparison. So Morgan, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your time and your expertise. I know our audience is going to take away a whole lot from this interview. So thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. And if you need to follow me on Twitter, I haven't created the fake Al Naimi yet, but you can follow me at CommodityMD.
Awesome. Okay. I didn't realize that you were on Twitter. So CommodityMD, no need to really follow anybody else. The guy to follow is Morgan. I promise you will not be disappointed. I know I will definitely add you shortly after we're done with
this. Thanks, guys.
All right. So this is the point in the show where we take a question from our audience. And this question comes from Dan Taggart.
Hi, Preston and Stig. My name is Dan and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I want to first say thanks for a great show. You guys are a wonderful resource and have had a lot of fun listening and learning from your podcast every week. My question is regarding inverse ETFs. A while back at the end of one of your episodes, you had discussed various financial instruments that an investor might want to think about holding during times of low return and overvaluation. I'm generally a long-only investor, but I am wondering what your thoughts are regarding inverse ETFs. Are these good investment vehicles to keep your money in as a hedge against an overheated market? Thanks.
All right, Dan. So this is a fantastic question. I think it really applies to the current market conditions here in the middle of 2015, in the summer of 2015, because the market is, very high. A lot of people would say that it's extremely overpriced. And there's some people that might not agree with that, but I think that the general consensus is that a lot of people think that the market's overvalued. And I think whenever you look at, a distribution, you're seeing it two standard deviations away from where it normally is at. So with those conditions, what you're asking is short selling the market, but doing it through an ETF or doing it through an index. I want to talk real briefly about if you're the type of person that wants to do a short sell. I think there's a lot of risk in short selling. Okay? And I think there's particularly a lot of risk in short selling an individual stock pick. Number one, the reason why I feel that way is because of buyouts. So let's say that, and right now in 2015, the perfect company that I would say is just doomed for failure, that is going to go into bankruptcy, is Sears. Whenever I look at their income statement, their balance sheet, it is just disgusting. It is really, really bad. So if I was ever going to short sell a company, that would be something that maybe I'd be interested in short selling because it looks so bad. It looks like it's destined for bankruptcy. But here's the concern. Is let's say that there's another business that comes along that has a much larger market cap and has a lot of resources on their balance sheet in order to buy out Sears. If I have that short position and I think that it's going to go down because it looks so bad, I'm going to get taken to the cleaners as this new company comes along, and there's talk on the street and in the newspaper of them being bought out. You're going to see the market price surge. I'm going to get called. I'm probably going to lose a lot of money. That's not anything that I feel like I can predict or control, and that is very bad. So that's why I have never short sold an individual stock in my entire life, and I don't ever intend on doing it, is primarily because of that specific risk. The other risk that I just gently discussed was that you would get called. So you'd have to buy this stock on margin, which is a loan or borrowed money. And if it moves against you and you get called, you have to come up with the resources in order to meet that call. I don't ever want to be in that position. That sounds like a very stressful position. So that's me. Other people are comfortable with being in that position. But what you're talking about is not short selling an individual stock pick and having to worry about a call. What you're talking about is investing into an ETF, which moves in the exact opposite direction of the market. So if the market goes up 1%, let's just say the S&P 500, let's say the S&P 500 goes up 1%, your short ETF or bear ETF, which they're commonly referred to, would move in the exact opposite direction by the same magnitude. I'm not necessarily saying that a short ETF is really all that bad of a thing to be in right now based on these current market conditions. And I think a lot of value investors out there might really kind of say, Preston, what in the world are you talking about? You sound like a crazy person right now. But I mean, that's really where I see this, because I feel like the market has been so heavily manipulated by the Fed. I'm really curious. I want to stop talking because I think I've probably made a bunch of value investors very mad. They're probably throwing things at their they're probably throwing things at their radio or their phone or smartphone or whatever right now. But I want to hear what Stig has to say about short selling, or primarily about an ETF, a short ETF.
Yeah. So Dan, I think I'm in the same boat as you. I'm primarily a buy and hold kind of guy, and I just think for me. I don't know if it's only because I don't like the stress. I definitely don't like to be stressed. Or it's also because I don't just feel comfortable about it. Because I don't think I would buy into shorting an ETF or an inverse S&P 500 index. And that is not me saying this is a bad idea. I just think that this is not the approach I have to my portfolio. So a lot of people would be asking me, so if you think that the market is high, why don't you sell all your stocks? I would never say to people they should just sell off all their stocks. I will not say to people either that they should go short the S&P 500. It really depends on what they're comfortable with. What I'm comfortable with is to buy companies when I think they're cheap and then just hold them for a long time. Not necessarily sell them if they're high priced, because sometimes stock might get high priced. Now, if Preston is comfortable with that, or if you're comfortable with that, or any other, I think that's probably right for you. And yes, my opinion right now is that the market is overvalued. I am just not comfortable enough to make the investment. Also, because it would be, it is my opinion, some sort of a short run bet, and that's just not my approach. It's not a bad approach, just not my approach.
And here's what's crazy is I agree with everything that Stig just said. I do. I completely agree with what you just said. And I think that if you're a conservative investor and you're trying to ultimately protect your principal, I think that that's how you got to look at it. And you got to also look at the fundamental nature of the market. No matter how you shake it, is that you are buying a business. I don't care what anybody says. You are buying a business when you buy a share of stock. So let me, try to defend, which I probably will have a very hard time doing, my earlier comment. So I guess I look at the market right now and you look at the Dow Jones and it's at 18,000. Okay. And so if you're buying into an S&P 500 short, how high do you really realistically think that the market can go? And if we're basing that off of the history of the last 100 years, which that's no judgment of what's actually going to happen in the future, but let's just say that you were going to do that. I guess you'd have to use the valuations in the year 2000 as basically the highest that it could go, which was what, a PE of like 75 or somewhere around in that range, somewhere very high. So if that's truly the case, then the market could go a whole lot higher. So, you know, maybe it could go up over 20,000. Maybe it could go up to 22,000, something like that. I don't know. I have no idea where it's, how high it's going to go, or how, or when the potential crash could occur. If it'll even be a crash, or it'll be like this slow, you know, slope down. I don't know. I have no idea if that's going to happen. But I guess if I'm going to try to defend this idea of a short position, I think that it'd be hard for the market to go much higher than 20,000 or 22,000. And if that's the case, the market, if it moved up that high, if it moved to 20,000, that's 10% higher than where it's at right now. And I think when a lot of people hear 20,000, they think that's really high. That's significantly higher than where we're at, especially because we've had a severe resistance level here at around 18,300 on the Dow. So, if you're looking at it from a short position and you think maybe the market could contract 30 or 40%, and you think that maybe the top level of the market would be around 20,000, that means that your downside would be 10% in a short position, and your upside could potentially be 40% or 50%, which is a lopsided downside versus upside position to be in. That's probably why I maybe see it as being something that somebody could do if you were comfortable with that. And I guess I could understand your mindset a little bit, but I am not promoting that position to anybody to do that. But I guess I can say I could understand why you would do that. So that's as gently as I can try to back up my position as a strong, hardcore value investor. I'd really totally agree with everything Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett would probably smack me in the face for saying something like that. But I just want to put it out there. I mean, I guess I want to voice my own opinions in addition to what all these other billionaires that are proven successes are doing. But that's all we got, guys. So that was a really fun question to answer. And we wanted to play that one because that's a really hard one. And it's something that I know I've been personally thinking a lot about. And I'm really happy to hear Stig's opinion. So, Dan, thank you so much for submitting your question. We're going to send you a free signed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. And in that book, you'll see Warren Buffett does not recommend that approach. But hey, it was really fun answering your question. And thank you so much for submitting it. If somebody else out there wants to get your question played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com. You can record your question there. We really appreciate these questions that everyone submits us. It's so much fun to respond to this and just get all the different email questions that we get and being able to correspond with our audience. We also want to definitely thank Morgan for coming on the show. I think you guys saw how knowledgeable he is about oil. It was just totally fascinating to have this interview with Morgan. So thank you so much. And that's all we have for you guys this week. So we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application.